Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Evening, my name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful to God for that and a lot of wonderful mentors that have helped me along the way and still help me. Still have some wonderful mentors out there. They're all over the place if you know where to look for them. And tonight we're on step three. Actually, for those of you who follow my steps, who have been in my steps before, some of us accuse me of basically doing 12 talks on step three. But let's see how this goes. It is good to be here. I want to tell you, I want to talk a little bit about the problem. I think it's important to sort of appreciate the problem. Now, this is all my opinion. I've been around for a little over 32 years, and you know, I'm not paid enough money to lie to y'all, and I wouldn't remember. I'm 64, you know, my memory's shot, which is kind of good if you want to live one moment at a time. You know, like I said last week, I have problems forming resentments because I can't remember who I'm supposed to resent or what they did to me. So, but in any event, I think it is important to talk a little bit about the problem the way I see it. Now, this is my opinion. You don't have to buy into it. You don't have to agree to it. I say some pretty goofy things. I say some things. I like to have people leave meetings maybe thinking about stuff. Doesn't bother me if I piss you off, you know. You know, our spiritual action says whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause is, something wrong with you. So if I piss you off, I have actually focused on something that's wrong with you. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm right or wrong. It just means there's something wrong with you that's disturbable. And so what happens is you'll go out there and try to figure out why does that guy piss me off, and maybe you'll inventory it, or you'll talk to your sponsor, you'll pray about it, and you'll figure out why I pissed you off. And by figuring out why I pissed you off, you'll figure out why your ex-husband, your ex-wife pissed you off. You'll figure out why the next-door neighbor's pissing you off. You'll figure out why a whole bunch of people in this world are just pissing you off. And once you figure it out and you pray about it, all of a sudden you'll find that people like me don't piss you off anymore, and you'll be happier. And then you'll come up to me and you'll owe me a copayment for like a spiritual MRI or something. You know, that's what you want. You want to hang around here, around people saying things that you can't even believe they said that piss you off so much that you have to constantly work on yourself as to not drink, not get mad, not get resentful, figure out why they piss you off, and then one day you'll be non-piss-offable. And then you know a peace that surpasses the world. You won't be upsettable. So, because that's why we drink, because we're restless, irritable, discontented, sober, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And we drink because for us to be sober in the real world is to experience pain. And we do a lot of things to avoid pain, you know. And if we can't use alcohol, we use sex. If we can't use sex, we use cars, we use money, we use a lot of stuff. And of course, we don't even think we're doing anything wrong because it's our natural way of thinking. Our alcoholic thinking, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And until and unless we can somehow get to that point, like it talks about in the big book, where we experience much of heaven, been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, where we lose fear of people, economic insecurity, and all the other stuff that's going around us that causes us to be disturbable, we'll never really find true happiness. You'll never really discover the new freedom and the new happiness they talk about in the promises permanently. So I want to talk a little bit about the problem, and of course a lot of this relates to what I see in my own life based upon my own experience. You know, I've been around here for 32 years, and I am one of those people that believe, like, you know, one of the books that they read that they thought was absolutely essential in the first 4 years, and I'm going to talk about that. This is the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I really, if anybody wants to get this thing, want to find out how I think and what's going on, get a hold of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which really discusses what AA was during the first 4 years. What they did, what they thought of, what the attitude was, what this brought. You know what they say? The big book was written in 1939. AA started in 1935. And I've said this before, but it bears repetition. In 1939, when there was a little over 100 guys, gals sober, they said, they wrote a book. And in the book they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You all go to what we called Alcoholics Anonymous today. So you think that what you're doing today in Alcoholics Anonymous and what you're hearing in Alcoholics Anonymous, you think it's the path they were talking about that they wrote down in 1939. That's what you think. That's what you think AA is. You think it's what you're doing today. I'm not going to tell you one way or the other what the deal is. I'll read a few things from the book. I suggest that you become open-minded if you really want this thing, and you read Dr. Bob and the Good Old-Timers, and I think it'll open your eyes as to whether or not we're thoroughly following their path, or whether they're following the, quote, wisdom of the rooms, which is a whole different thing. Because if you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous, although I love the fellowship, it's a wonderful thing, you'll discover that this is not Well People's Anonymous. And sometimes the wisdom of the rooms, which is essentially sort of like AA by committee, might water it down a little bit. There's a tendency for alcoholics to try to figure out how they can smooth off some of the rough edges, make it a little bit more digestible. Now, that sounds like a little extreme, because our part of our nature is, you know, we want to try to duck and run and look for the loopholes and do the easier software. That's our nature. The nature of the people in these rooms, you know, I mean, I'm one of you guys, is to try to figure out how to do this thing as comfortably as possible. And if you really want to do this thing, you really got to get yourself real uncomfortable. Because this is a serious disease, and it loves for people to rest on their laurels and get comfortable, but they're usually headed for trouble if they do. So there's a possibility that in order to really get the good stuff, you might have to be willing to do the stuff that most people are unwilling to do. So I want to tell you a couple of stories about my life in AA. I'm just going to sort of like skim the surface of the problem to make the problem a little more specific. Because one thing I do realize after 32 years of experience, one of my sponsors once said, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. So, believe me. It's better to sort of like, one of the books they read in the first 4 years that they found absolutely essential was the book of James. And in chapter one of the book of James, it says, rejoice when you have problems of all types, trials of all types. You know, if you've been around here more than a few months, then you realize that after you stop drinking, everything isn't wonderful. Sometimes your mind is exploding. Sometimes you're worried about all the things that are going to happen 6 months from now, or a year from now, or what chat. You know, your mind just takes you to places you don't want to be, and it's uncomfortable. And of course, what the book of James says, it says you rejoice when you have all sorts of trials, because perseverance through trials, through faith, by looking at God, is what really matures your faith and makes you, and actually helps you grow. Helps your character grow. But if you're an alcoholic like me, the way I like to persevere through trials is drink. So if you don't drink, you got to find some other way. I want to try and find an easier, softer way. So trials is where it's at. And so don't be so concerned if you're going through a lot of rough times in here. I'm excited. I was telling a couple guys that came up here. I pray that people go through rough times when they're in here, because most of the people that I see that drink or drug or don't get out of this thing are people that come in here and get all the money, get all the sex, get all the gals, get everything, and then 6 months down the road, it's adios muchacha. And then I get a call from them 3 years later when they're in Dade County Jail and they don't have any teeth. You know what I mean? So believe me, you know, the problem here is they get too well too fast. And there's something Doc Tebow said, it's ego deflation in depth over a period of time routinely. So there's not necessarily anything wrong if every week or every 2 days you're going through just one more crisis that you have to run to the rooms for, talk to your sponsor for, do something, try to figure out, because you know you're going to die. You know, because that's the way we think, right? There's no like probation in here. If you have a crisis, it's going to lead to death. It's going to be a terrible thing. So here's the problem. So the problem really is, and we're not going to talk about drinking alcohol because I can't solve that problem. You know, if somebody has an alcohol problem, they really need to drink until they want to stop drinking. I do believe in drinking. I don't believe in coming in here prematurely. I think you need to drink until you're scared of drinking, until you really want to stop drinking. And If somebody wants to use that as an excuse to drink and blame me, that's good. You're allowed to do that. Go out and drink and go out and drink and say you did it and you almost died and it's Russell's fault. I can handle that. There's no problem. When I came in here, I didn't want to drink more than anything else in the world. You know, they say if you want, we have. You only go to any length. You get any length is listening to all the bullshit you can in the pot in the world and still stay here because you ain't want to drink, because you don't want to drink, because I was so scared of drinking. So, you know, I do believe you got to 100% sort of get that drinking thing down. And I happen to believe that if you drink enough, you'll eventually get sick and tired of drinking. I may be wrong about that. That may be a problem. But so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor would take me around to rooms. And at that time, my sponsor's name was Bob Sullivan. And I've had three sponsors. Bob Sullivan, all died sober. Joe Snyder died with 35 years. Wonderful, wonderful man. And my current sponsor is John Glenn, who's not here tonight. I excused him. He usually comes up here with me. Him and Pastor Carey, they're both pastors. Pastor Carey's here in the back. It's his wife's like 85th birthday. So I said, you're excused. You don't have to come. He's home with his wife. So in any event, Bob Sullivan used to take me around to my meetings. And he took me to a meeting. And I was sober. I was as sober as I am right now. I was physically sober. I was a couple months sober. He took me to a meeting at the South Dade Group. And he says, you know, this guy's a pretty good speaker. I want you to listen to him. And I was 31 years old at the time. I was a trial attorney. Still a trial attorney. And working for the DA's office, and you know, I mean, I wasn't stupid. I was an intelligent guy. You know, I was, I was married, and he put me in this room, and I sat in the back of the room, and this guy started talking, doing one of these AA talks, and he said, "My name is Joe, and I'm a recovered alcoholic," and I had gone to about 10 or 15 AA meetings, so I was pretty much an expert in Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, pretty much, and being smarter than anybody else, and obviously more educated, and I told my sponsor, I think I told you this story, I took him into, I have a wall in my office with about 20 diplomas and certificates, and departmental honors in mathematics, national science, all this sort of stuff, to test how brilliant I am, and I showed my sponsor, who never even graduated sixth grade, he was used car salesman from Chicago, I was terribly under-sponsored. I was supposed to be sponsored by Einstein, but he was dead at the time, or Jesus or something. But I got stuck with this used car salesman, you know? Because when I came into AA, you understand, alcohol had done such damage to me. I had like two neurons working. They were saying goodbye to each other. It was like, forget it, you know? So I got stuck with this guy. He was driving me around. He was buying me dinner. What more could you do? What would you do if a guy was driving you around buying you dinner? You know, And he did it for a month. And somebody said to me, is he your sponsor? I mean, I was always with him. I said, no. And I said something, because I was brilliant. I said, how do you do that sponsor thing? And they said, you ask him. And that took me another 3 weeks to figure out how to do that. You know what I mean? Because I was brilliant. You know what I mean? I had all these diplomas. So I took him to my office once. I said, look at all my degrees, Bob. And he looked at me and says, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees. You know what they do with those. So in any event, I'm sitting there in this room, and the guy says, my name's Joe, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I had been to about 8 or 10 AA meetings. I had spoken to a lot of people about AA, and had gone out to a lot of AA dinners. And everybody I knew said they were recovering. As a matter of fact, they explained to me, absolutely, that there is no cure. That there is no cure, and I bought into that there's no cure, and I still believe there's no cure, and we're recovering, and we have a daily reprieve. And this guy said that his name was Joe, and he was a recovered alcoholic. And I had never heard anybody in AA say that they were recovered. And I knew I wasn't recovered. You know, recovered to me is cured. And I knew I wasn't cured, and I knew nobody I knew was cured. And I immediately said, this guy has a lot of nerve. He thinks he's better than me. And I took offense that some guy from the podium would be telling people that he was cured. And basically, because I knew he was like putting himself higher than me, talking down to me, you know, in a condescending, you know, you know, you don't know who you're dealing with, buddy. You know, I mean, I got degrees, you know. And I just kept on thinking, how can they let a guy like this chair an AA meeting. The guy absolutely knows nothing. He's obviously stupid. He's hurting all these people. I ought to raise my hand. They ought to let me talk. I know more than he does. I know you can't be recovered. And the next thing I know, I'm thinking about this guy and who he is and why he's saying that and how can they let somebody like that. Next thing I know, the meeting's over. I hadn't heard a word he said, but why would I want to hear anything he said? He was like stupid. You know what I mean? He was like, they should ban him from Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I walked out of my smart said, so what'd you think? And I said, he was terrible. Having heard him introduce himself, you know. He was terrible. He said, I said, what do you mean he's terrible? He says, he said he was a recovered alcoholic. And I had read the big book and everything like that. And he said, and my sponsor said, well, you are. I said, what do you mean I am? I'm not recovered. I'm recovered. He says, no, Russ. He says, read the foreword. It says, we are over 100 men, women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I said, well, I'd never seen that. I guess he had. Imagine what else this guy had to say. This would be a much better talk if I had listened to him, you know what I mean? But he upset me, you know what I mean? He upset me, you know, because he had, you know, in the manner in which, he, you know, his attitude, the way he introduced himself, it bothered me, you know? So so about a month later, my sponsor told me I had to join a home group. I had to pick a home group. And so I asked him, I said, well, what group do you belong to? He says, I wouldn't like my group. So I didn't like that because, you know, I eventually joined this group. It wasn't trying me not to have them. He says, I want you to go around and you pick up a home group, you know. So I went to the South Dade group, that group I had gone to, and I walked in there, and I had always gone to meetings with him. And this was like one of the first times I had gone into meetings by myself, alone. So I walked in, you know, I had about 2 or 3 months, whatever I had, a couple months. And I walked in, it was like an afternoon meeting. And there were, you know, all these people in AA around, you know, that had more time. You know how AA people are? If you've been to one of these meetings, there's all these tables. And they had, you know, like 3 people sitting at this table and 4 people sitting at this table. You know how they all clump together? You know, like AA little cliques, AA little groups. Like people know each other and they're talking, they're laughing, they're drinking coffee. And I didn't know anybody, so I sat in the back, you know, waiting for them to recognize me as the AA god or, you know, the king of AA or certainly somebody. I'm just brand new. Certainly somebody's going to come over. I mean, Love and Tolerance is a code and tell them how much they, you know, are you new or introduce themselves. So I sat in the back of the room and everybody else was sitting together in little groups. And the guy started the meeting and, you know, and he was picking on people to talk. You know, you talking, you know, they were going around and talking and nobody even, like, acknowledged me. Nobody even spoke to me. Nobody even said, hey, there's a new guy, like, in the back of the room, or do you have anything to say, or anything like that. And I'm, and you know, as the meeting's going on, I'm getting upsetter and more, I'm getting more upsettable and upset. I mean, because they were wrong. I still believe today they were wrong. You know, I was told that the newest guy in the room, he's the most important guy in the room. And the youngest guy's most, they didn't even come up and say hi to me. They didn't care about me. And what kind of group is this? Nobody's interested in what I have to talk about. I have good things to say. You know, I'll cure them all if they'll just call on me and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, I realized I was with a bunch of selfish, you know, people. They didn't give a crap, and these people deserved all to die. I mean, you know, this, like, I couldn't, you know, I don't even know what the meeting was about, because who can sit with a bunch of selfish, I mean, what kind of group gets together? You got a brand new guy that doesn't even ask, you know, who is he? None of this stuff, you know? So I went out of the meeting, and my sponsor said, so what did you think of the group? I said, it was the worst group in the world. It's a terrible group. And he said, you know, I sat there. It's just a bunch of little cliques. Just a bunch of little cliques. They get together. They don't care about anybody. Nobody even introduced themselves to me. They didn't even come up to me at the meeting. So he says to me this, because as I said, my sponsor was not like Albert Einstein. He was not that bright. You know what I mean? But, you know, I was kind of vulnerable at the time. So I was sort of skittish. So, I mean, I couldn't really rebel against him. So he said, well, this is what I want you to do. So, you know, I'm an alcoholic, so what I expect, I told him the whole story. So I expected him to do what most alcoholics expect you to do when you say bad things about other people behind their back, sort of join in harmony. Yeah, they are a bunch of jerks, you know what I mean? So this is what he says to me. He says, this is why AA people are really, AA old-timers are really crazy. Because they don't think like a decent human being alcoholic should think. They think like sideways. He says to me, well, this is what I want you to do. You know, they're full of cliques and everything. He says, yeah. He says, I want you to go back tomorrow and join one of the cliques. I said, what? He says, I want you to go back and join one of the cliques. He wanted me to go back and take action and actually, like, go up to him like I need them, you know what I mean? Almost like I need them, you know what I mean? You know, that's like saying, like, I need you, like, I need them. So, you know, as I said, I wasn't too well at the time, and, you know, he had me doing all sorts of things I didn't want to do, so I went back to the group, and I walked up to a table, and there were four of them there, and I said, hi, my name's Russell, and I'm brand new, I only got a couple months, and they said, hey, how you doing, Russell? And they were, like, real nice to me. They sat me down, one guy got me some coffee, they started talking to me, he said, and then they said to me, he says, why don't you chair the meeting? And they, you know, I mean, my God, and then they had me chair the meeting, and, you know, I read how it works, and I said a couple things, and they all said, keep coming back, and, you know, and I got up, and he says, so how'd you like the group? He says, it was the greatest group. I said, it must have been a whole bunch of different people, you know what I mean? These people were sharp, you know, they were good, you know. So about two months later, I'm driving with my sponsor. My sponsor sponsored me and a guy named Bobby. And Bobby, now my sponsor's name was Bob. He sponsored me and a guy named Bobby. So I don't want you to get confused here. Bobby was one of these guys. Now, I picked up a white chip, and I'm not taking any credit for this. I give all credit to God, and I just never had time necessarily to have a drink. But I picked up one white chip, and that was the end of that deal. You know, I've screwed up in a lot of different ways, but not in the drinking deal. But Bobby was one of these guys, like, he was, like, on a timer. You ever hear one of these guys, he says, I'm coming, you know, like, I always drink after night. At night, I'm coming to that time again. It was like a countdown, you know what I mean? It was like, he was good for like 90 days and then there was the drinking. He was good for like whatever, 100. Tommy had like a time. I don't know, it was 30 days, I can't remember, and then he would drink again. And what would happen is he would be great for 30 days, and then like on the 30th day, he'd vanish. And we'd go up and pick him up at Bark, and we'd bring him down, Bark, and we'd bring him down, and you know, he'd vanish, we'd bring him down, and Bobby would clean him up again, give him some suit of clothes, or give him a few bucks and take him to meetings. He'd be good for another 30 days, and then he'd drink again. And, you know, I'm watching all this. I'm watching as this is going down. I mean, I'm watching this deal. And, you know, I'm feeling sorry for my sponsor because he's being taken advantage of. I mean, it was clear to me that this guy wasn't serious. It was clear to me that he was taking advantage of my sponsor. This guy didn't want to stay sober. You know, but my sponsor was such a nice guy. He may have had like 20 years, but he didn't have any clue as to what was going on here, you know? And I felt really bad for my sponsor, and this guy was such a jerk, and you know, and so I'm driving the car, and we're going to pick him up again for the third or fourth time from Bark. And I said to my sponsor, I said, you know something? You ought to turn this car around. I was livid. I was mad. I was upset. I said, you ought to turn this car around. I said, let me take you. And I'm a trial attorney. I had my facts down. I mean, I was right. I was like Alki right. Like, if you disagree with me, you got to die because you're so stupid. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, you know, and I mean, I had photographs, I had 3x5 cards, I had the whole thing written out. I mean, I had, you ready for this? Facts. I had facts on my side, okay? And I said to him, I said, you ought to turn this car around. This, we did this last month, we did this month before, we did this month. This guy doesn't give a rat about you, he doesn't give a rat's ass about me, he doesn't care about anything, he just wants to stay sober, he does the whole thing, he says the same stuff, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, in true Alki fashion, I must have probably repeated myself 10 times, you know, because, you know, I'm talking and talking and talking and talking. And my sponsor's looking at me as we're driving up the Bark, and then I said, you ought to turn this car around, and that's it, and forget about it, and that's it. And I stopped, but I really didn't stop because, you know, I'm like my own lynch mob, you know what I mean? Like, now I'm having a conversation with the lynch mob, the guy's in my mind, you know what I mean? Yeah, you tell me, You know, because it's like, once you get that locomotive going, you know, your mind, you don't stop until next Tuesday, you know, until another Friday, you know? So I'm going, you know, you can tell those wheels are spinning, you know, because of that brilliant alcoholic mind, you know. And so my sponsor says to me, he says, and there's nothing he could say because I'm telling you I was right. I was absolutely right about this guy. So he says to me, he says, and by the way, this is the same guy who told me to go back and join the group. The same guy who said to recover, the same sponsor, you know. And he says to me, he says, are you done? And I said, yeah, I'm done. He says, no, Russ. He says, are you done? And I said, yes, I'm done. He said, listen, are you done? Are you done? Are you okay? Are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. He said, Russ, listen to me. I said, what? He says, listen to me. He says, I said, what? What? I mean, what's he going to say? I was so right. And this is what he said. He didn't graduate sixth grade. He was a used car salesman. And this is what he says to me. This is like amazing. He looks at me and this is what he says. You're not going to believe this. He says, Russell, I mean, what could he say? Everything I said was absolutely truthful. Everything I said about Bobby was the truth. This is what he says. He says, Russell, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. I said, how can it not bother you? Everything bothers me. I hit him with logic. He hit me with magic. And the problem with it was, I wanted everything he had, and he wanted nothing. He had apparently had what I had. And he had worked years never to have it again. I think it's called alcoholism. 9 years later, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsoring guys, doing the A thing, doing everything, the meetings, the step meetings, everything like that. And I'm on the phone with my new sponsor, my another sponsor, Joe Snyder. And all these old timers are the same. They all think squirrely. And I'm on the phone with them, and I'm complaining about my wife. My wife of now 32 years. 4 kids, 6 grandkids. And I'm complaining about her because she, you know how she is, you know. Look, that's something to talk about. You know, she doesn't respect me, she doesn't appreciate me, you know, she does crazy things, she does, you know, she has opinions and shit. I don't even know. It's bad. You know, she laughs at me. And So I'm telling him, I'm on the phone, and I said, and then she did this, and for 20 minutes, I'm giving him like the Bobby speech. She did this, she did that. I'm giving him a rundown of every single thing she did, and this is why, you know, I know it says whenever you're disturbed, you know what the problem is, there's something wrong with us, and, you know, isn't there such a thing as justifiable anger, but they don't live with my wife. She's crazy, you know what I mean? So I'm giving bam, 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 chapter and verse, you know, and I give him the whole thing. And then I give it over him, and I give him in detail. I'm telling you in detail. She said this, and I said that, and she said this, and he did that, and blah, blah, blah. And she is so wrong, it's unbelievable. She was, like, wronger than Bobby could ever be wrong, you know? And he says to me, he says, after I'm done talking, he says, are you finished? And I said, yeah. He says, no, are you finished? He said, I said, yeah, I'm finished. He said, so this is what he says. He says, so why are you upset? I said, what are you talking about? What do you mean, why am I upset? Well, why are you upset? I said, I just told you why I'm upset. I said, Joe, I just gave you 20 minutes of specifics as what she said and what happened and what she said. You ever been to discussion meetings where people would give you specifics as to, you know, then this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened, and they give you this whole long story? I gave them the story. I said, I just gave you the chapter and verse as to what the deal was and everything like that. And he said, this is what he said. He said, well, that's not why you're upset. I said, what are you talking about? He says, that's not why you're upset. I said, that's not why I'm upset. He says, no. You didn't say anything else. I said, that's not why I'm upset. Everything I told you, he says, nope. He said, everything she said, that's not why I'm upset. He says, nope. And he didn't say another word. So what am I going to do, you know? You see, he was smart. He knew I was an alcoholic. He knew if he told me why I was upset, I'd tell him, you know, he's full of crap and he didn't understand, and I'd give him all the crap, you know what I mean? Because you can't help anybody unless they need help, they want help, and they ask for help. And you got to have those three things going. Don't you dare volunteer to help somebody unless they ask for it, you know? And then they don't make the mistake of thinking just because an alcoholic's pathetic that he actually wants to hear what you have to say, you know? And that, just because he's drowning, don't make the mistake that he really actually wants you to save him. But so I said, that's not why I'm upset. He said, no. So I said, Well, are you going to tell me why I'm upset? And he goes, you really want to know? I said, well, of course I want to know. Are you going to tell me why I'm upset? He says, listen, stupid. Because he loved me so much, he always talked to me like that. And dear, tell me. Listen, stupid. He says, you're upset because you're upsettable. It was like Zen AA, you know? Now, I didn't realize it until years later that he was actually telling me the same exact thing that my first sponsor said when he said to me, but I didn't understand it then, and I really didn't even understand it much in 9 years, but I understood a little bit better. When my first sponsor said to me, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you, he was saying to me, he was pointing out and saying to me the same exact thing that my other sponsor said to me 9 years later when he said, you're upset because you're upsettable. He's saying, you're still suffering from this disease. You see, everything upsets you. The wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, imaginary shit, upsets you. This world upsets you. This world, how many people live in the world I live in? You live in the same world? You know, I was driving up here. You know what happened? My car broke down. We had to call AAA. Cars break down. I mean, my car is not allowed to break down, but cars break down. Did you notice, if you live in the same, you know, there is a lot of moving parts in this world. You notice how many people there are in this world? There are bombs blowing up. There's stuff going on. And even the stuff that isn't around you, it gets piped into you. There's a lot of crap going on all over the place that's disturbable, that's crazy, that's nutty. There's stuff that's going on right in front of you that's going to go on. There's like cancer happening. There's people dying. There's people drinking. There's alcohol. There is so much crap going on that you can't control, like everything. You know? And I'm 9 years sober and I'm going ballistic because my wife looked at me funny. You know? So let me ask you something. Here's the problem. Okay, I know you stopped the drinking thing. How are you going to protect yourself against that deal? How are you going to escape that deal? What are you going to do about that deal? Because that's the real alcoholism. You know. What's the point of getting sober so you can live a life of quiet desperation, be pissed off and worried all the time and complaining? Well, you just try to make it. You just try to hang in there till you get to the next discussion meeting so you can vomit all over everybody and try to get a little relief for another hour or two and not drink and make believe that you're sober and you're doing okay. You know, I mean, what's the deal? What's that all about? And then every once in a while you see some guy in AA, you know, one of those guys, you know, one of those people like Bob Sullivan or Joe Snyder, you know, where they seem to be walking in the world and nothing seems, they're steady. Steady, you know, I heard somebody said that really what love is, what really is about, you know, guys that are just steady. They're never way up, they're just all right in the world. And you think, you look at them and say, well, they must never have problems. How are you going to do that deal? You may stop drinking, but how are you going to stop the thinking? How are you going to stop being the thumb-sucking crybaby? How are you going to stop the complaining? How are you going to stop the feeling sorry for yourselves? How are you going to stop the, I can't believe this is happening again? You know, when is this ever going to get better? How are you going to stop that deal when you're 15, 20 years sober, and you're always pissed off somehow at somebody or something, or worried, or scared, or going to sleep, or lonely? How are you going to stop that crap where you're not drinking, but life sucks? How are you going to do that deal? When you suffer from a disease that has to do with being selfish, self-centered, driven by hundreds of fears, self-seeking, self-delusion, stepping on the toes of others, they retaliate. Self will run right, but usually don't think so. How are you going to do that deal? Well, you know, the big book has an answer to that. It says we must get rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. It says God makes that possible. That's our solution. That's the A solution. God makes that possible. It's all about God. Only God will cure that deal. Only God will get rid of that. Only relationship with God will get rid of that deal. Now I'm going to read you some things from the big book, okay? You're adults, you get to do whatever you want to do with this deal. You just get to decide as to what kind of life you want to live. Let me read you just a couple of things in this book, okay? Just some stuff. And I've read a bunch of things before, but, you know, repetition is good. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Each individual in the personal stories, remember it says the personal stories? That's the thing that really shows us. Our personal stories before and after make clear the whole deal. It says our personal stories describes in our own language and from our own point of view the way he established his our relationship with God. Now I want you to listen to the term relationship with God. Relationship with God. All they do in this book is talk about developing a relationship with God. Developing a relationship with God. They don't talk about good orderly direction. They don't talk about doing the next right thing. And I'm not putting you down. If you want to believe I'm putting you down because you're doing that, because I know early on, you're going to do whatever you have to do to get where you have to go. And if it's making the group your God, or if it's making the A group your God, or doing the next right thing, or good early, if that's what you need to do in order not to drink, then you do that deal. But as you mature in this thing, you're going to find that this world is so powerful, and the stuff that's going to happen in and around you is so toxic and powerful, and the forces about you are so much greater than you can ever imagine, that you're not going to be able to do the next right thing all the time. You're not going to be able to just say no all the time. You're not going to have the strength to do that because the needed power is there. That's what chapter of the Gnostics is all about. This sort of thinking has to be abandoned. First of all, we had to playing God. Doing the next right thing, I'm never going to do that again. I promise I'll always be good. Just doesn't work for us. Sober, drunk, or whatever, it doesn't work, but the needed power isn't there. We had to find a power greater than ourselves, and so we wrote a book where we had to talk about God. That's the only salvation in this deal. That's what was right for them. That's what they did during the first 4 years. They didn't do any of the stuff they're doing right. That's what they did during the first 4 years. That was the rocket ship ride to the fourth dimension. That was experienced too much of heaven. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language, from his own point of view, the way he establishes his relationship with God. Let's move on. Just a few, you know, quotes. Just a few things. I mean, you know, when they say things, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. I think they were serious. You know, when they said that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives, probably no human power. But we can't manage our own lives. No human power to do it. God couldn't would if he were sought. And then right after that, they say being convinced of that, we are now at step three. I think they were serious. I take them at their word. When they say things like this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We're his agents. He's the father. We're his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed the freedom. I think they were serious. I don't think they really gave a crap whether or not you liked it or not, or whether it hurt your feelings, or you didn't want to do it. I mean, they took it as a matter of fact, since you're an alcoholic, that your chief characteristic is defiance. They knew you didn't want to do it. They know you don't want to do it. That has nothing to do with it. When we sincerely took such a position, the position of trusting in God and having a relationship with him, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I mean, do you want remarkable things to happen? Listen, it's great not to drink. If you go through all sorts of crap, I don't care what's going on, you haven't had a drink today, you're a success. But don't you want something more than just the not drinking program? Is that all you're in here for, the not drinking program? Then don't drink. Don't drink and see how that works for you. It says when we all sorts of remarkable, if you want remarkable things to happen to you, it says we had a new employer being all powerful. Good orderly direction is not all powerful. It's not God. It's a mere philosophy of life, which they say in chapter of Gnostics is not what we're talking about. They say if a mere philosophy of life or better moral values would have helped us, we'd have been sober long ago. Every one of us before we got here is saying, I'm going to stop doing this. I'm not going to drink again. I'm going to be good. I'm going to be a good boy. I'm going to go back to school. I mean, how many times do I have to see a guy pick up a white chip and say, this time I'm going to do it? No, you're not going to do it this time. Because you still really think you're powerful. You think by declaring in front of the group that this time you're going to do it, that somehow you have some innate power to do it. I'd rather you pick up the chip and say, I have no idea how to do it. I could be drunk in 5 minutes. Then you might get to the point of where you really understand what's going on here. You don't have any power to do this. You better find a power greater than yourself. You know, alcoholism, it's like dancing with a gorilla. You stop dancing when the gorilla's tired. We had a new, it's an old joke, come on. We had a new employer being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. If we stay, they're talking about a deity. Let's talk about, they're not saying, you don't get close to good orderly direction. You don't perform his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. And if it sounds a little religious, it's because all they were doing prior to that time is reading the Holy Bible. And the books they found absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, the book of James, and Sermon on the Mount, which is all they read, which is all, everything here comes out of the Bible. That's why it says, we thought, after you say the third step prayer, it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves to him. Abandon ourselves to him. Utterly. Utterly is a pretty strong word. I love the words they use here. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves who are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what we would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And I can just read on through the book. It just goes on and on. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people, places, things. It is dependent upon, here it goes, his relationship with God. Go to the back of the book. Go to Vision for You. I don't care where you go. It says our book is meant to be suggestive only. Look, we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. This is the great fact for us. This is the great fact for us. We are God-believing people. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the records of your past. Give freely what you have. We'll meet you on the road to happy destiny. It says in the fellowship of the Spirit. The fellowship of the Spirit is the fellowship of individuals who trust God and have a relationship with God. And they had no problem saying this because they were so locked in to the God deal, it was pathetic. Now, 70, 80 years down the road, you can't say God in the meeting without getting slammed. You can't say the Bible or Jesus or even in the meeting. You can't even talk about this stuff in a meeting without getting slammed. Because after 70 years of treatment centers, where you've been told, nothing wrong with treatment center, where you've been told is what this program is really about, is not drink and go to meetings. You know something? You do the not drink and go to meetings program. You do that program. You want to know something? You won't drink. It's been proven. If you don't drink and you go to meetings, you won't drink. And you will get what you get out of that program. And when thousands and thousands of alcoholics found that you didn't have to believe in God, that you didn't have to do it the way they did the first 4 years, you could actually come in here and not drink, go to meetings, and then act out and do whatever the hell you wanted to do and live whatever life you wanted, that's what they did. Because why go for a program where you have to actually get morally finer and shoot for, you know, like they say in step six, the difference between the men and the boys, the men are those who want to grow in the image and likeness of their director and try, their creator, and try repeatedly, step six, on all their defects so they can grow in his. Why go for that stuff when you can just do this stuff, don't drink, go to meetings, and live whatever life you want to live and not have anybody bother you? And if anybody bothers you, can say, well, you take your own inventory, this is my program. And then you can basically live alcoholically but not drink and still pick up the medallions. I'm just going to read a couple more things. We'll take just a couple more minutes because I really want it, because I know a lot of you guys aren't going to read this. I want you to know what they were. You know, when you read that thing, when you go to meetings and you hear them say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, that was written in 1939, I want you to have some sense of what they were doing in 1939. I'm going to read you what they were doing in 1939, where they said, you know, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, you do what we do, you get what you got. You'll experience much of heaven. You'll be rocking the fourth dimension. I want you to have some sense of what AA was about in the first 4 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I don't want you all to leave here deluded to think that you're actually doing this thing. Because you might think like AA's failing you. How come you're not getting the stuff they were getting? So I'll tell you what, I'll just read this stuff, and you can look at it and see whether I'm making this crap up. And then you can ask yourself, how many times do you hear about this stuff in AA meetings? What would happen if you talked about this stuff in AA meetings today? Okay? And believe me, I'm just picking out two or three things. You know, I mean, if you read this whole book, page 96, Dr. Bob noting that there were no 12 steps at the time and that our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of, later said they were convinced that the answer to their problems were in the good book, in the Bible. To some of us older ones, the parts that we found absolutely essential were Sermon on the Mount, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the book of James. Go on. On the other hand, you want to talk about step three? You ever hear people say, well, don't talk about God, you might scare off the newcomer? You ever hear that? You know? Okay, well, this is you know when they said, really, I've seen the person fail, slowly followed our path? This is what they did during the first 4 years. On the other hand, we were taking them upstairs and getting them on their knees to surrender, which I felt was a very important part. Because alcoholics are arrogant, defiant. You know, that's what they are. They're arrogant and defiant. The surrender was more than important. It was a must. Bobby, who came to AA in February 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated that you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting you were powerless over alcohol and that your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. There you can see the beginning of the 12 steps. He said, we call that the surrender. They demanded it. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. Hey, listen, how many people in here before they came in here were forced to get down on your knees and say, Lord, I give my life to you, I give my life to you. Listen, you couldn't get in here. Now, you may not like that, and I'm not saying we should do that now, but I'll bet it cut out a lot of bullshit during the meeting. I'll bet it was like a real qualifier, you know what I mean? We got any salesmen in here? You know what I mean by qualifier? You know somebody who's ready to buy as opposed to somebody who's just kicking the tires, you know what I mean? I'll bet if you had one of those meetings where they all got down on their hands and knees and everything, you didn't have any problem with that third step deal. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. Can you imagine how powerful those meetings were? Can you imagine the power and the quality of those meetings? A guy would get down on his knees and says, you're not ready. Adios, muchacho. Come back when you're ready. I'll bet if they didn't die, a lot of them came back. Ready. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did. If by accident you didn't make it in the hospital, you had to make it in the upstairs bedroom over the Williamson's house. Dorothy S.M. recalled the 1937 meetings when the men would all disappear upstairs and all of us women would be nervous and worried about what was going on. After about an hour, a half an hour or so, down would come the new man, shaking, white, serious, and grim. And all the people who were already in AA would come trooping down after him. They were pretty reluctant to talk about what had happened, but after a while, they would tell us that they had a real surrender. I often wonder how many people that come in now would survive an experience like that. A regular old-fashioned prayer meeting, said Dorothy, who was then married to an AA member, Clarence Snyder, the brewmaster. You know, when they say, rarely have you seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, that's what they were doing. This is the stuff they were doing. Clarence Snyder, who was like one third or fourth guys, was one of the ones who came in Cleveland in the beginning of 1938. I'm just going to skip out most of this. I'm just going to read this last part because Bob Smith sponsored Clarence. He got Clarence in. Doc Smith came in later and took over. Clarence was only about 30, 31 years old. He sat on the edge of my bed in the hospital, in Clarence's hospital. Well, what do you think about all this? Then he paused and looked at me doubtfully. And then Bob Smith says to Clarence, he says, I don't know whether you're ready yet. You're kind of young. Clarence says, I was down to 135 pounds. I had no job. I had no clothes. I had no money. I didn't know how much more ready I could be. Recall Clarence. Still, I had to convince them that I was ready. Then he asked, "Do you believe in God, young fella?" He says, "Do you believe in God?" He always called me young fella. When he called me Clarence, I knew I was in trouble. Then Clarence says to him, I'm not making this crap up. This is in our big book. This is what they were doing. This is when you say, rarely have we seen a person fail so early to follow our path. Don't think you even knew what they were doing until you read this book. It says, he says, "Do you believe in God?" And this is what Clarence says. Well, what does that have to do with it? Man, you come into people here and say, "Do you believe in God?" You know what they're all going to say? Well, what does that have to do with it? This is what Bob says. Everything. He didn't say, "Oh, I might scare him off." He said, "Everything." He says, "I guess I do." Guess nothing. Either you do or you don't. We had to make a decision. God either is or he isn't. There was no pussyfooting around. "Yes, I do." "That's fine," Bob replied. "Now we're getting somewhere. All right, get out of bed and on your knees." Don't get mad at me. Write New York and tell them to burn all these books. They're the ones who are publishing them. Just because people aren't reading them, because it makes them nervous, because they might make you do it, and then we'll find out where you're really at and how defined you really are, and whether you're really ready to surrender, and whether you're really ready to go to any length, or it's all just a bunch of horse shit. Then we find out where you're really at. We're going, he says, "Get down on your knees. We're going to pray." "I don't know how to pray." "I guess you don't. But that's all right. Just follow what I say, and that will do for now." And I did what I was ordered to do, Clarence said. There was no suggestion. Now, I'm just reading this about, you see how many more things, listen, you can read this thing. I just read the milder stuff. And you guys go to this, and you guys read this book where they talk about the promises, being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, experiencing much of heaven. They lose fear of economic insecurity. They lose fear of people. They knew a new freedom, a new happiness, all this stuff that God is doing for them and doing for, and you think that they got all that stuff and you're going for it and you want that stuff and you think you're going to get it because you're doing what they're doing in here now today. Because you think you're doing what they did. And you're not even doing anything close to what they did. As a matter of fact, you laugh at the people who were doing what they did. You look down on the people who are doing that. Your heroes are the ones who say, "I'm spiritual, not religious." They look down, that's your heroes. And you wonder why you're thumb-sucking crybabies. You wonder why you don't have this thing yet. Why you're whining and crying all the time and worried about everything in this world. And you don't have any sense of yourself. And you worry about, and you wonder, when am I going to be okay? Never. Because you're not ready to surrender. Now listen, this could be all bullshit. You can get mad at me. I don't really care. You know, that's fine. It's no big deal. This is the deal. You know what Bill Wilson said? "The Lord has been so wonderful for me, curing this, the terrible disease. I have to keep talking about it and tell, you know why I say this? You know, 1,000 people may think I'm bad, but may think I'm crazy, but you want something? There's always one or two that are inspired. And those are the only ones I'm talking to anyway. You know, I never know which one or two they are. Because they're the ones that are going to be around in 20 and 30 years and acting good purpose and be in good shape. They're the ones that, so you don't have to believe me. This is what you need to do. This is what you want to do. If you really believe in the second step, in that open-minded deal, you know, that tolerance deal, that open-minded, here what you need to do is you need to read this book. Conference approved. AA Literature. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And you decide whether this is you decide what they were doing back then. You know, this was written in 1939. In 1939, they basically tell about everything they were doing to stay sober and get what they got. And you decide, you look at what they were doing then and the things they were doing and the intensity in which they did it. And by the way, if you read this, you will have a better understanding of this. And then you decide for yourself, is what they were talking about in here and here, looking at this, the same thing that's going on in the AA meetings? And what you're being fed is AA today. Or are you doing a different type of AA? Like AA Prime. The not drink and go to meetings AA. Like the treatment center AA. The AA that doesn't piss anybody off AA. the AA that's the easiest, the AA that, you know, this is the AA where everybody can sort of stay sober, but we don't hurt anybody's feeling AA. You know, like nobody will really get real sober. Nobody will experience much of happiness. We'll just sort of like have that sort of dull, not drinking sort of thing. But nobody will ever really get this thing. But at least nobody will get mad at us or pissed off at you. And you decide. This is your life. You decide which you want to, when you want to do. Because I can promise you this. There are people that are doing this AA. Trust me. There are people. Not a lot of people. There are people that are doing this AA. You know what it says in the big book? It says God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Don't even think about giving yourself an excuse, well, nobody's doing it the way Russell's telling me. There's a lot of people doing it this way. There's a lot of people doing it the old-time way, the back-to-basics way. There's a lot of people doing that if you want it. But at least before you decide not to do it, at least find out what they were doing. That way, 10 or 15 years from now, when you drink again or you're feeling crappy or anything like that and you're trying to figure out why me, you can say, well, it's because, you know, it was put to me. I was told. You know what I mean? I decided not to do it. So God bless you. I'll see you next week on Step 4.